I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. My friend Bill grew up on the East Coast back in the 1950s. I didn't think he'd mind if I borrowed one of his stories. Bill comes from Cape Breton Island. It's a high, rocky chunk of land that stands between the Gulf of St. Lawrence and the storms of the Atlantic Ocean. Well, for the Scots who saw it in the 18th century, it looked wild and cold and forbidding, just like home. These were the men and women who founded the fishing communities and, like their compatriots down the New England coast, took to sea in small boats to make a living. So it was with Bill's family. He and the other kids brought their lunch to school. And each morning, Bill would pray that his mother would hand him a peanut butter sandwich. See, when times were tough, Bill got a hard, cold, boiled lobster in a brown paper bag. Bill says he remembers being so ashamed that he would throw the bag away, lobster and all, and go hungry rather than endure the teasing of his schoolmates. How times have changed. Now, lobster is the food of the well-to-do, all but an occasional treat for the ordinary people. Trevor Corson has made his own discoveries about the lobster. After years of traveling and living overseas, he took a job as a sternman on a lobster boat out of Maine. He got to wondering, so what goes on underwater? How do lobsters see and feel and find their food and their mates? The result of his curiosity is a new book called The Secret Life of Lobsters, How Fishermen and Scientists Are Unraveling the Mysteries of Our Favorite Crustacean. This hour, a chance to toss your own lobster tales and questions into the connection pot. In a world of convenience foods and vac-packed meats, the lobster remains the one meal that, well, it still looks like itself when it lands on your plate, the one food we still tear apart with our hands. So does that make you want to know more about it or less? What if you always wanted to know about the lifestyle of the humble lobster? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Trevor Corson's here with me in the Connection studio. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Dick.
So after those years abroad, back to Little Cranberry Island and life on a lobster boat, what was it that took you from the exotic Asian life to a place in the country that's in many ways cold and forbidding?
Yeah. I was, by my mid-20s, I was living in a Buddhist temple in Tokyo, writing about Buddhist priests and their practice. And it was a bit of a jump. And of course, when I told some of my friends that I was moving to a little island off the main coast to work on a lobster boat, they all thought I was completely insane. But looking back, I have to say there are a few warning signs. So I spent my summers on this island as a kid. It's called Little Cranberry Island. Now, of course, spending your summers in Maine doesn't make you a Mainer by any stretch of the imagination, but I did develop this fascination with lobstering. I'd go down to the wharf in the afternoon and watch the lobstermen unload their catch. And by the age of five, I was inspired to build my own lobster boat. And now, it wasn't especially seaworthy. It was made of cardboard and didn't have a bottom. But I did catch a lobster with it, although I have to admit it was my cousin dressed in a cardboard lobster suit we made for him. But it whetted my appetite. And years later, I thought, why not? I was looking for a new writing project, and I didn't know what the story would be, but I thought, surely, there will be some story if I go to the Maine coast and work as a lobsterman.
Now, Captain Bruce Fernald, you knew when you were a summer visitor to Little Cranberry Island, whatever persuaded him to take you on as a sternman?
Well, that's the funny thing about lobstermen is they don't really hire you. You know, I knew Bruce as an acquaintance, and I went up there and expressed my interest in working on his boat. He'd been recommended to me by one of his brothers as a good guy to fish with. And, you know, lobstermen are very noncommittal when it comes to hiring sternmen. They don't want to get stuck with somebody who's not going to be able to do the job because it's extraordinarily difficult work. So Bruce kind of said, well, yeah, you know, if you're up here, sure, you know, come on out. And for me, it was a major commitment because I was moving out to this little island that had only 70 people on it year-round. And so, you know, I showed up the first day of work and went out, and it was quickly clear it was just a matter of proving myself. And apparently I managed to do that because he kept me on.
Captain Fernald is actually listening in as we speak now. He's on a cell phone in, where are you, Bruce? In Addison, Maine.
Yes, I'm Addison, Maine, on my way to a boat launching.
Oh, so your feet are on dry land or you're sitting in a car or something, right?
Yeah, I'm standing out in the middle of the field. How you doing, Trevor?
Hey, Bruce.
How was he really, Bruce? Was he any good?
Oh, yeah, he was right top-notch. Second best only to my wife, who was with me for 3 years. And so he was really good.
You've been, five, six generations of Fernald's Fishing Lobster?
Yes, six generations so far.
What about the twins? Are you talking them into taking over from you at some point?
I'm not talking them into it. They're just going to school and getting their education, and who knows what will happen down the road, but they're on their own when that comes to that.
How's your season so far, Bruce?
It's been very good. Sorry, there's a truck going by here.
It's all right.
It's been a good season. Lots of little lobsters, lots of big ones. A lot of egg lobsters. It looks real healthy.
Now help me out with this, because the little ones you call the shorts. The ones with eggs, you call them the eggers, right?
Mm, yes.
And then there's the V-notchers. What's a V-notcher lobster?
Well, it's whenever we catch a female lobster with eggs, we take a knife or a special V-notching tool, and in one of the flippers, the flipper to the right of the middle flipper, we put a quarter-inch V-notch in it, and we release it. Because it is illegal to land a lobster with eggs. But when that V-notch is in there, after the lobster releases her eggs, if somebody catches her again, they have to throw her back.
And people pretty well stick to those rules, do they?
Well, it's a state law and federal law, so it's a pretty stiff fine if you don't. So, and it's for our own good. It's for our future. So they do stick to them, yes.
And the one of the secrets is that it's a practice which has kept the lobster stocks pretty healthy through all six generations of your family's fishing.
Well, this happened 50 years ago when it started, so my father's been fishing about 50 years, so it's been going on since he's been in the business. And it has kept us going, and it will keep our future generations going, along with other conservation practices.
I gather you're up there looking at this boat launch with an eye to maybe trading up from the double trouble to something else?
Yes. I'm put my mortar in, and this boat is going in the water today. It's the first one of its model, and I'm going for a ride in it. And if I like it, I'll keep my deposit there.
Bruce, I want to thank you for being with us. That's nice to hear from you.
Well, thank you, and it's a great book. I really enjoy the book, and we'll see Trevor later.
See you, Bruce.
Thank you. Bye.
I'm going to get you to read from a part in the book where I guess you're not really introducing Bruce, but you're introducing him to us in the world of lobstering. It's why don't you just go ahead and read it? It doesn't need any explanation from me, Jeff.
Yeah, this is near the beginning of the book, and I was trying to figure out how to structure my book, and of course, Bruce is one of the main characters. I tell his story and the story of several of the other fishermen on the island, and this seemed a good way to lead into the story. The oceans of the earth abound with lobsters. Lobsters with claws like hair combs sift mud in offshore trenches. Clawless lobsters with antennae like spikes migrate in clans in the Caribbean and the South Pacific. Flattened lobsters with heads like shovels scurry and burrow in the Mediterranean and the Galapagos. The eccentric diversity of the world's lobsters has earned them some of the most whimsical names in the animal kingdom. There is a hunchback locust lobster and a regal slipper lobster. There are marbled mitten lobsters, velvet fan lobsters, and even a musical furry lobster. The unicorn and buffalo blunthorn lobsters inspire admiration. The African spear lobster, the Arabian whip lobster, and the rough Spanish lobster demand respect. Nowhere in the world, however, is the seafloor as densely populated with lobsters as it is in the Gulf of Maine. Though a less sophisticated creature than some of its clawless counterparts, the American lobster, scientific name Homarus americanus, is astonishingly abundant. But at 5 o'clock on a September morning in 1973, the young Bruce Fernald didn't know that, and he wasn't interested. "Hey, Bruce." The door opened. "Come on, son, get up. We're going fishing." Bruce groaned, rolled over, and cracked open an eye. Still dark. Jesus, after almost 4 years in the Navy, riding nights away in the bunk of a destroyer, rounding the Cape of Good Hope in 40-foot seas, and what happens the first time he tries to sleep in his own bed back home? His father wakes him up before dawn to go get in a boat.
Trevor Corson reading from his new book, The Secret Life of Lobsters, How Fishermen and Scientists Are Unraveling the Mysteries of Our Favorite Crustacean. 2 years as a sternman, right?
That's right.
Did you ever get tired of that moment just before the trap clears the water when you're going to discover if you've got a good haul of lobsters or, I don't know, just a pile of mud?
A lot of stuff comes up in those traps, and sometimes none of it is lobsters. There is a moment of excitement there when the trap breaks the surface. Sometimes it's more like dread if you've not been having a good day, and you just hope to God there's some lobsters in it. The fisherman, and, you know, watching Bruce work was an extraordinary experience because I realized how tuned into the lobster man has to be. These guys really know the prey that they are catching because they can't just set their traps willy-nilly and hope to catch lobsters. Mm-hmm. They're pursuing the lobsters. They know where they're going to be, at what season, what type of bottom, what the tidal currents are doing, the water temperature. So when those traps are coming up, it's not just a lottery. Bruce has set his traps very carefully on purpose. In fact, not just where he knows the lobsters are going to be, but where he thinks they will be. He's anticipating where they're going to be. And if the traps aren't there when the lobsters pass through on their seasonal movements and migrations, then he's already missed his chance. So there's a real sense of investment in what is going to come up in that trap. And when they come up with lobsters in them, you feel gratified. When they don't, it's time to start shifting the gear around or at least have some more patience, one or the other. And it just, the seasonal cycle goes through all these swings, and you really have to have a kind of deep inner center of balance, not just physically aboard the boat, but also mentally, knowing that, okay, I'm going to keep trying. And Bruce's persistence was the other thing I was very impressed with. He really stuck with his routine, and it is a grueling one.
All that time on the stern also got you thinking about what was really going on down there, the behavior of lobsters that was going on out of sight that you weren't able to watch.
Yeah, and again, I really owe the fishermen for sending me in that direction. It was just so clear that these lobstermen were amateur biologists in their own right. I mean, in a way, they were sort of scientists. They were constantly watching what was coming up in the traps where and attaching explanations to it that had to do with the environment, ecology, and biology. Now, they weren't conducting the scientific method or anything like that, but it did get me to wondering, what more do we really know about these critters? And that is where the scientists come into the story. And I'll tell you a little story. I was out fishing with...
I'm going to ask you to hold that story just because I don't want to have to cut you off. We are taking a short break. We'll be back to talk more with Trevor Corson, author of The Secret Life of Lobsters, that mix of scientific knowledge and fisherman's lore and his own journalistic skill in digging out just what it is that causes lobsters to molt, to mate, to fight. Just hang out in those dark crevices. 1-800-423-8255 for you to join our conversation this hour about the lobster. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Trevor Corson is the man who spent 2 years at the stern end of the Double Trouble, a Maine lobster boat with Bruce Fernald. And based in part on that and much work that came after, is the author of a book called The Secret Life of Lobsters, How Fishermen and Scientists Are Unraveling the Mysteries of Our Favorite Crustacean. In fact, the story you're about to tell is one of those moments when the fishermen and the scientists actually ran into each other?
That's right. So Bruce and I were out lobstering, and we saw another boat that to me was unfamiliar. And immediately Bruce steered his lobster boat, the Double Trouble, towards the other boat, and I thought, oh, geez, you know, there's going to be a fight. These guys are very territorial. Some guy's trying to muscle his way into Bruce's territory. And, you know, I recently heard about an old-time Lauschman who refused to go from a wooden boat to a fiberglass boat because wood would stop a bullet better. So that gives you a sense of how serious they can get. But we went over to this other boat, and Bruce was all smiles, and he shouted out a greeting to a guy aboard the boat. And I looked over, and there's this man with an orange beard in a wetsuit, and it turned out there were people in the water. This was a team of scuba divers from the University of Maine, and they were conducting a census of lobsters up and down the Maine coast. And Bruce knew this guy. His name was Bob Stenick. He's a professor at the University of Maine. And that was my first introduction to Bob. And what struck me was how friendly they were. And immediately they started exchanging information. Bob started asking Bruce all sorts of questions about what he'd seen where in his traps and what he thought the lobsters were doing. And Bruce asking Bob some biology questions. And this was my entree into the world of lobster science, and I ended up spending days with Bob Stenick out on research ships, watching him go down in submarines looking for lobsters, operating underwater robots looking for lobsters, and he became, of course, a major character in the book.
You know, the part about the book that struck me, perhaps that surprised me more than anything else, Trevor, is that so little was known about the way that lobsters reproduce. I mean, you had these old-fashioned beliefs of French naturalists who thought that maybe there was some kind of copulatory organ hidden somewhere in that shell, but nobody really knew how it worked.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of the funniest things I discovered doing research for this book, was that there was this big debate throughout. I mean, it goes back to Aristotle even, and then it reached its peak in the 19th century, this debate among naturalists over how lobsters have sex. Who knew that this was such contentious material? And I delved into this question, and I discovered some incredible things. I found a couple of scientists who have spent hours and hours and hours watching lobsters in laboratory tanks.
This is Yella Adam and Diane Cohen?
Yeah, the work takes place in a laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod. And it's part of the Marine Biological Laboratory. And Yella is this wonderful Dutch neuroscientist who came to the States 30 years ago, and he's been studying lobster behavior ever since. And Diane, who started out as his student, went on and did fascinating work and now runs a organization called the Lobster Conservancy in Maine, which is doing great stuff. And they are both characters in the book. And the mating experiments that they conducted are just mind-boggling.
Okay, so how does it work? Let's cut right to the chase here.
Well, it turns out that if in any given lobster neighborhood, the local animals are very social. I mean, we tend to think of lobsters as totally isolated, kind of curmudgeonly creatures who don't like anything or anybody and stay away from each other. And they do, in fact, hate each other, but it's not an isolated thing. They hate each other actively. They spend a lot of time beating each other up, and this serves to establish a kind of dominance hierarchy in a given neighborhood. And usually what happens is that one male in a neighborhood will establish himself as the local ogre, the alpha male, the dominant, and he goes around beating everybody up all the time.
The other males, females too.
Yeah, nice he guy. Beats up the other males first, and then once he's established his status, he goes around and beats up everybody, including the females. Now, there is a purpose to this. The females seem to find these advances, this bullying behavior, particularly arousing. Of course, what it's doing is it's sending them the signal that this is the toughest male around, so he's probably the best guy to mate with. Now, the male doesn't really do anything except beat people up, and after his round of beatings, he goes back to his little shelter, which, of course, is actually the best shelter in the neighborhood. He always occupies the best one, and he just hangs out there. And then what happens? The female lobsters start to come calling. And what they do is create this kind of sisterhood where they all say, okay, we all want to mate with the dominant male. The other guys don't get any dates at all. They sit there forlornly while the big guy gets all the action. And all the females band together and create this kind of sisterhood. And they are able to time their mating sequences so that they can all mate consecutively with that dominant male. And the extraordinary fact here is that female lobsters have to take their clothes off to mate. They can only do it when they've just shed their old shell. So,
quick pause here.
Yeah.
A lobster sheds its shell. What does it look like then?
Yeah, this is fascinating. When I was fishing with Bruce, we actually had a lobster come up in a trap just on the verge of shedding, and we put it in a bucket and watched it shed and get out of its shell. It takes an hour or so, and what happens is the back of that shell where the tail and the body meet cracks open, and the lobster basically has a short period of time to wiggle out, and if it doesn't do it in time, it'll die. It'll get stuck in there, and it's got to...
So all the, like, little stringy bits of meat that are in those little legs, they all have to pull out of...
Not only that, the claw, those big, huge claw muscles, the lobster has to diet away a bunch of its claw muscle before shedding in order to be able to pull those big claws through that... You've seen the lobster has tiny little wrists.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got to pull those big claw muscles through those little wrists to get out. And every hard part of the lobster, including the lining of its stomach and its anus and its all these body parts, all of that has to come out in the shed. So a poor female lobster, just imagine her going through that. And then 15 minutes later, she's got a mate. It's a big day.
The mating happens face-to-face, right?
They do it in the missionary position. That's quite right.
And there is, in fact, like something kind of weird that's going on here because the male isn't, in fact, fertilizing the eggs at that moment.
Right. There are a couple of different ways to have mating occur. One is you fertilize the female on the inside, which is what humans do. The other is to fertilize the eggs out in the water, which is what a lot of fish and other sea creatures do. The lobster has got this perfect middle ground. It is the advantages of both. The female lobster's shell includes this little, it's like a fanny pack. And when they mate, she opens this thing up, and the male deposits his sperm inside, and she closes it back up again. And then when she's ready later to extrude her eggs out onto her tail, where they develop for 9 to 10 months, then she unzips her little fanny pack and uses the sperm to fertilize the eggs.
It just sits in there waiting for that
moment. Yep. And the astonishing thing is that female lobsters get more savvy in the battle of the sexes as they grow more mature. A big female lobster doesn't need a man around at all. She can mate once and then fertilize several batches of eggs for, 4 or 5 years before she's got to find another man.
The dominant male, does he always stay dominant? I mean, how does some young buck lobster eventually challenge this dominant male?
Right. So the thing is, while those other lobsters who aren't getting any action, they're sitting around forlornly, well, they're busy eating and growing, and that gives them, while the dominant's putting all his energy into fertilizing this long string of lucky females, the other guys are over there improving their physique. And when it comes time for them to molt up to a bigger size, they will probably have a much better chance. Now, they got to wait for their shell to harden and all that, so they'll be in fighting condition. But once they molt up to a bigger size, they'll have a shot at dominance too.
And they'll go and take on the king of the reef or wherever he happens to be at that time.
Yeah, and there's a terrible scene in the book where, this dominant who's had this string of excitement and action and being the stud, I'll let you guess what happens.
No, tell us the story. It's too good.
He's beat up everybody in the neighborhood over and over, and then finally he's fertilized, 5 or 6 females in a row, and then it's time for him to rest and grow, and he molts and shed his shell, and the next day when the scientists come into the tank, they can't find him anywhere, and it turns out in his vulnerable moment, while he was all soft, the other lobsters took care of him.
I love your description of the other male lobster sitting stone-faced.
Yeah, it's a dangerous business being a dominant.
Don't really know what happened to Mr. Big. He was here yesterday. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Trevor Corson is here with me. We're talking about his book, The Secret Life of Lobsters. And we're going to Southern Pines, North Carolina. Linda's joining us on the phone. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thanks.
I just wanted to tell you a very sad story about how I've been ruined for life on lobsters. I grew up in Miami, and my father was from Maine, and he ran into a bit of bad luck, and we had to move back to Maine when I was very, very young, and we were very poor, and I was very embarrassed about how poor we were because we moved from Fort Lauderdale.
Mm.
And part of growing or living was that we lived from the donations of all the people in the area, from their garden and from crab and lobster and clams that my father was able to get. And I could not eat it. It was terrible. I thought it was the most horrible food in the world. And to this day, I cannot eat it. My husband and I, a few years back, went back to Maine for our 25th wedding anniversary. And I thought, surely by now I can eat lobster. And we got it, and I got sick. I could not. I couldn't even bring it to my mouth.
Is it psychological, Linda, just because it reminds you of that time when you were so poor?
It must be. It must be. It smells delicious when it's cooking,
yeah.
But I cannot eat it. I can, as a matter of fact, I can clean out a lobster or a crab better than anybody. I can get more meat out of it because I don't snack while I'm cleaning them out.
Trevor, you write in your book about how the lobster did not have an auspicious beginning as regal food in New England either. It was...
Yeah, well I thank you, Linda, for that story because it does remind us of the history of this food. And Dick mentioned his friend Bill in the introduction who has a similar story. And lobster was not a high-class food or even a desirable food for a long time. And fishermen in Maine back in the 1800s would eat lobster, but that was mostly because the fish they caught were too valuable for them to eat. They were going to sell those, so they had to settle for eating lobster. And one of the things I talk about in the book is this interesting transformation that's occurred. Part of it has to do, I think, with the fact that urban people who'd eaten lobster meat in tins, for a long time it was canned in the 1800s, the whole lobster business was canned lobster, and they would, some of those urban people discovered they could go to this pristine, you know, rugged beauty of Maine and go down on the wharf and buy a live lobster, and that was sort of like communing with nature or something, having this fresh lobster. And then they popularized the idea, and it became this sort of desirable food. But Linda's story is very interesting because it does remind us that coastal Maine does have serious problems with poverty, and lobster for a long time was associated with poverty, not with luxury as we associate it now.
So the people on Little Cranberry Island, a feed of lobster, is that something that they would go, oh, God, not lobster again? I know if Bruce was here, I'd ask him, but you lived there.
Bruce loves lobster, and most people nowadays on Little Cranberry Island, you know, in fact, people in the lobster industry now are doing fabulously well. There are very few poor lobstermen I've ever heard of nowadays because, and we can talk about this, the lobster population in Maine has expanded. It's booming. Times have never been better for lobstermen. And there's some worrying signs on the horizon about what may happen in the future. But now lobster fishermen are doing well. Lobster's a good meal, and people on the island like to eat it.
I do want to go back to questions of the science and how that mixes in with the fisherman's lore. But I want to go next to Parrishville, New York. Helen's waiting on the phone there. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Well, I have a question. I've talked to some lobstermen down in the Florida Keys. Well, of course, they're not the lobsters with the claws. But they said that the first 2 years of life in a lobster's life, they don't know where these lobsters are. They're not in the shallow waters of the Keys. And, you know, where are they? And is this something that is similar to the Maine lobster?
Helen, that's a very good question. We do know something about this with the American lobster in the Gulf of Maine. It turns out that little tiny baby lobsters of the clawed variety in the Maine coast, they bed down after being larvae in nursery grounds. There are specific places where they seem to congregate as babies, and they crawl down under a little rock, and they are there for the next 3 to 4 years. They will stay right there. And in fact, Diane Cowan, who we talked about earlier, one of the scientists in my book,
yeah.
She runs a program throughout New England now that has volunteers that they go down to certain coves that they've identified at lunar low tide, the lowest low tide, once a month, and they turn over rocks and count little baby lobsters.
Okay.
And they have a running census going, and they're hoping this will provide data on the future of the fishery by keeping an eye on how many babies there
are. You describe them as things the size of kidney beans. Fair?
There is this interesting stage in the lobster life cycle, and it's called the super lobster. And they are about the size of a kidney bean. And this is between the larva and the proper lobsters. And
so they look like miniature lobsters at this point? They have little claws and
legs? Exactly like miniature lobsters, but they fly around in the water, and that's how they earned the name super lobster. Like Superman, they fly with their little claws outstretched in front of them. And they're...
Wait a second, they go forward?
Yeah, it's the only time in the lobster's life where it can swim forward. And it swims almost as well as a fish. And these super lobsters are like, they're the lobster's secret weapon in survival, because their job, their sole purpose in life is to fly around, shoot down to the bottom, look for a hiding place, and if they don't find one, like Superman, they clap their little claws together and leap over a tall building, and they fly back up into the water and fly around some more and look for a new hiding place. And they will target a little stone, and when they find one, they'll crawl right under it, and they'll stay right there and hide. And that is why a lobster larvae, once it reaches the super lobster stage, has a much better chance of survival than the kinds of larvae like crab or fish that just kind of fall wherever on the bottom. They're probably, most of them are instant fish food.
You got taking all this down, Helen?
I love this. I'm so fascinated. I'm going to have to turn over some rocks.
How big are, Helen, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
How big is a super lobster when it ceases to be a super lobster and is sort of doomed to scuttle around on the bottom?
Its claws, from the tip of its claws to the end of its tail, it's about an inch. These are tiny things. And I went out with Diane one night. It was late. It was sort of 6 o'clock in the evening. The sun was going down, and it was just October, November, and the wind was blowing, the cold. And she's got this miner's headlight strapped onto her helmet, you know, and we're heading down into the mud and the seaweed to go turn over rocks and look for these little tiny things. She's amazingly good at finding them.
1-800-423-8255 to join my conversation this hour with Trevor Corson. His new book is called The Secret Life of Lobsters, How Fishermen and Scientists Are Unraveling the Mysteries of Our Favorite Crustacean. Stick around. We may talk a little bit about cooking lobsters. No promises, you know. Let's wait to see what we pull up when we lift the trap. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Trevor Corson's writing has appeared in The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, The LA Times, and The Boston Globe. His latest is a book called The Secret Life of Lobsters, How Fishermen and Scientists Are Unraveling the Mysteries of Our Favorite Crustacean. Trevor's here to unravel those for us on the program today. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Next to Oxford, Mississippi, and Monica's on the line. Hi, Monica.
Hello.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. It's hard, and you know, being in Mississippi and all, we don't know a whole lot about lobsters here, and we use crawfish for bait. But I've always wondered, I've always thought that that lobsters mated for life.
Monica, I hate to break it to you. You know, you remember, maybe you've seen that Friends episode where Rachel and Ross are getting together, and Phoebe says, "Oh, she's found her lobster." Suggesting, of course, that they're going to mate for life. But in fact, Rachel and Ross should have been furious at that, because what it meant is that they were about to have a 2-week fling. The system has evolved so that the female lobsters can all mate with the one male, and the whole thing for one female takes about 10 days to 2 weeks. She only needs time to convince him that she should move in with him, and this is a funny story. Basically, the male's running around being the big dominant stud, but the females are pretty much coming up and drugging him into submission. And they accomplish this by pheromones. So the female will say, "Okay, I want to mate with this big stud." Go up, check out his shelter, and squirt pheromones into his shelter. And this kind of calms him down, reduces
sort
his level
of aggression.
Sort of
lobster aromatherapy, right?
A lobster aromatherapy, exactly. And it is a powerful drug. And he is sort of drugged into submission, and then she moves in. And that's when she starts to get ready for molting. And actually, female lobsters experience PMS, pre-molt syndrome. They get very irritable before the shed and push gravel around and stuff inside the shelter. Then they shed that shell, and then they do their thing. And once that shell is hardened up again, she's out of there.
There's a piece of your writing that sort of picks up the story from the moment after. Maybe I can get you to read that for Monica.
Sure. This is just after the act.
The FCC demands that we skip the act and just go to the after part.
You can go find the juicy details in the book. After copulation, the female huddled in a corner of the shelter while her new shell hardened. In exchange, she left her old shell as a postcoital snack for the male. He began nibbling it just a few minutes after dismounting, the lobster equivalent, perhaps, of edible underwear. By evening, the female had sufficiently recovered to get up and eat some of her old shell herself. But the male, feeling satisfied, was now keen on cleaning up. He gathered the remaining pieces of her discarded exoskeleton and tossed them in a heap outside the door. The other lobsters in the tank sidled up to the pile like nervous looters and ran off with whatever piece of her shell they could carry. Over the next few days, the dominant male began to leave the shelter regularly again, resuming his bullying and foraging for food. At first, the female stayed indoors, her shell still thin as paper. When the male brought back food, she would occasionally snatch a chunk for herself. The nourishment strengthened her, and she tried to exit the shelter, but the male jealously blocked her way and boxed her claws. One night, while he was out, she left. She came back before morning, and they rested side by side during the day, but they went their separate ways again that night. A few days later, the female, her shell growing rigid, was resting inside the shelter when the male returned with food. This time, when she tried to help herself, he snapped at her. Soon afterwards, she left and did not return.
In the next chapter, will J.R. and Sue Ellen ever be together in South Fork again? 1-800-423-8255. We are talking about lobsters. Cambridge, Massachusetts. Janet's on the line. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I'm really enjoying this show. Here's a perfect segue for talking about what lobsters eat. I grew up in Narragansett, Rhode Island, and I lobstered in the summers when I was in my early 20s with a friend. And I was wondering if you could speak to the unglamorous side of lobstering, which is stringing bait, sticking your head in a bait bucket that's full of maggoty fish and stringing that bait and preparing it to put in the lobster pot. And what you smell like for days.
Yeah. You didn't like that part of the job, Janet? Is that what you're getting at here?
I was living with my grandmother, and she made me take my clothes off in the garage and immediately launder them before I came in the house.
My advice is always, if you're going to go out and work with bait on a boat, wear clothes that you can burn afterwards.
Right.
Yeah, well, I can speak to this because that was my job for 2 years. I was, as the stern man, one of the most important responsibilities I had was stuffing the bait bags. And so you spend 8 to 10 hours a day leaning over this giant bin full of rancid herring. And, you know, you're up to your wrists and elbows in the stuff and stuffing it into little bags. And
the idea being that the more rancid it is, the more it smells on the ocean floor, the more it's likely to attract lobster. What's
actually,
the deal?
Actually, that's not true. The surprising thing, because people smell it, they think it must be the case. But in fact, lobsters will prefer a fresher bait most of the time. The question is just, between the time that fish is caught and the time you're using it aboard the boat, there is no way to prevent it from getting a little ripe. And it's salted down, so it's pickled, basically.
Right.
So it's not going to, you know, become full of maggots right away. But it is a very unique smell, and you've got to get used to it or you're in big trouble. And I remember the first day I was out with Bruce. Afterwards, came home, went over to a friend's house to watch a movie, and I had showered for like half an hour after that day of fishing, and I sat there while the movie, not paying any attention to the movie, sniffing under my fingernails because the smell would not go away no matter what I did. You just learned to live with it.
And Janet, will you still eat lobster?
Oh, I love lobster. I had some this weekend down in Rhode Island, and I eat lobster as often as I can get it. I absolutely love to eat it.
Knowing what they eat's not a deterrent then, right?
No, I've gotten over that part of it, and I just I just basically enjoy eating it now and look forward to hearing about your recipes because I have a couple of favorites myself.
All right. We're going next to Brighton, Massachusetts, because I think Jim has a question about the consumption of the crustacean. Jim.
Hi.
Hi there.
How are you? I eat a lot of lobster, and I probably will continue to, but it does seem a particularly brutal way to kill an animal. When I throw that lobster into the pot, it doesn't stay there without any resistance. I have to hold down the lid, and I hear a lot of fighting going on there. So I don't know what other types of meals we actually throw into a boiling pot of water, but as bizarre as it is, my question is there a more humane way to cook a lobster?
Jim, I'm so glad you called.
And are they sensitive? Is it really just a chemical and reactions to their thrusting about, or do they really feel it?
The lobster nervous system has actually been very well studied because lobsters' nerve cells are very large, so it makes a great cell for all kinds of neurological research. So I didn't know this until I was researching the book, but it turns out lobster nerves are used all over the country in all kinds of research for a variety of purposes. And scientists have not been able to identify anything in the lobster's nervous system that we can recognize as a pain receptor cell. So we don't know if they feel pain. It's possible they don't. Scientists who work frequently with live lobsters note that they don't really seem to have any kind of painful, they don't seem to exhibit a painful reaction even at the loss of a claw, a limb, or a wound. But let's go ahead and assume that they do feel something akin to pain. The scrambling in the pot is a standard escape mechanism in response to any kind of stress, so that's not an indication. What we do know is that the lobster's nervous system is about equivalent in complexity to a mosquito. So that puts it in a little bit of perspective, and I just like to point out to people that we used to do this sort of thing with quite a bit of our food. We would, you know, behead the chicken in the backyard and bring it into the kitchen and pluck it and cook it. So I actually see lobster cooking as this is going to sound crazy, but as a spiritual opportunity to reconnect with the life, the web of life that sustains us. Now, to answer your question more specifically, yes, there are things you can do to reduce the trauma for the chef and the lobster. And in fact, most professional chefs kill lobsters by stabbing a giant kitchen knife straight into their head and cutting them in half. That's by far the most humane and quick way to kill a lobster. Now, obviously, that will make people even more squeamish, some people, than putting it into a pot. If you don't like that, frozen lobster is becoming increasingly good. There are ways to have it taste very, very fresh, so you can get that in a lot of supermarkets now.
But you can even take a live lobster and stick it in the freezer.
But that's exactly what I was going to say. You're quite right, Dick. And I mentioned some interesting science experiments conducted by the Food Science Department at the University of Maine, where they actually tested some theories for cooking lobster. And putting a lobster in the freezer, a live lobster, for 10 minutes or so, or a little longer if it's bigger, slows down the lobster's metabolism, and it makes the whole process of dying and cooking much quicker and less dramatic. And there are even some things you can do with aside from the kitchen knife. There are some other things that I describe in the end there. So, you know, I just like to keep it in perspective and point out that lobster is all the things you would want in a meat. It's free range. It's, organic. It's caught by local individuals instead of large corporations.
I love the little thing that now the fishermen are putting their own ID, their own website on the rubber bands that go around the claws, so you can take the band off and go to the website. And there's Bruce Fernald's.
Exactly.
Site.
I was up on Bruce's boat a couple of weeks ago, and he had some of those rubber bands with the website and the number, and you can go look him up online. It's great.
Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky for our next call. Tom's joining us. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for calling. Are you a lobster fan?
I am a lobster fan. I was going to tell a story about my first experience with lobster, but all this talk of cooking, I recently heard on a cooking show that you can cook lobster in your microwave, but that you need to overcome the sound of the tap, tap, tapping on the glass door.
Yeah, I would reach for the big kitchen knife before I
have, I have been afraid to go there, so yeah. I haven't tried. I can't testify to that.
No, I think just stay away from there, Tom, for the sake of all of us and the lobsters as well.
Well, my first experience eating lobster was when I was a young boy of about 11, and I went to Sandy Hook, New Jersey, and got a big lobster plate with my 8-year-old brother, and they asked me to wear a bib, which for an 11-year-old, you just don't ask them to wear a bib, so I wouldn't, of course, and so neither would my brother, and I put those big, you know, crackers around that lobster, and I squeezed as hard as I could, and I'll bet I splashed a pint of lobster juice all over my brother. Every ounce.
You're still talking, though, are you?
Yeah. He probably doesn't eat lobster anymore. But
there's a great
the whole bib thing was pretty much too much for me. But
I'm with you on that, and I get it. I like the part in the book where you actually figure out on our behalf that there are right-handed and right clawed and left clawed lobsters. Who knew?
Yeah, it turns out that they just sort of accidentally start favoring at a very early stage in life one claw over the other for certain tasks, and then one of them will develop into the crusher and the other into the cutter claw. And it seems to be a fairly random phenomenon. They just start to develop that way. And it's very interesting because at the same time, the lobster's neural circuitry is changing, and it's the neurons that connect to its claws start to grow bigger than the ones connecting to its tail, which means it's shifting from an escape mode, hide, you know, I'm a tiny little lobster, into attack mode. I'm a big lobster with big claws, and I can take care of myself.
You throw back the big ones when you're working on a lobster boat. What's the biggest one you ever saw?
Well, the trap obviously limits the size of a lobster that can get
inside. So the ones
inside.
The size of a Volkswagen can't actually get in there.
Exactly. Although Bruce once hauled up, I saw this lobster, it happened before I was working with him, but he once hauled up, I think it was a 14 or 15-pound lobster, and it just had gotten its crusher claw stuck in the entrance to the trap and couldn't get it out, and it hauled up hanging off the side of the trap.
This is like the size of a small dog, right?
Yeah.
It's a really big lobster.
It's a big lobster.
Trevor, I want to thank you so much for coming in to be part of our program today. It was great having you here.
This was fun, Dick. Thanks a lot.
Trevor Corson's the author of a new book, The Secret Life of Lobsters. We also talked with Bruce Fernald, captain of the Double Trouble, and a lifelong lobsterman from Little Cranberry Island, Maine. You can learn more about lobsters and Trevor's book by checking out our website. We are at theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Hey, what the jelly-